TheChairShot.com. Always use your head.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Five Rounds Podcast, the only podcast out there with the cardio for those deep water championship rounds. I'm Max, and with me again is my son, Carlos. Carlos, how are you?
Oh, not too bad. How's yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Great event last night. UFC 252 kind of lived up to the hype. Well, in some of the fights weren't as interesting as they could have been, but we'll get into that anyway. Quickly, let's just run through these early prelims and prelims. So we started the card with Kai Kamaka getting the decision against Tony Kelly. Then Chris Dorcus getting the first round knockout against Parker Porter in the heavyweights. Going on to the televised prelims, started the show with Livia Renata Souza getting the decision against Ashley Yoder. Big victory for Souza there. Then we got Danny Chavez getting the decision against TJ Brown in the featherweights. Verna Yandiroba continuing her good run of form, beating Aphelis Herrig, who hasn't been in the UFC for nearly 2 years, got the first round sub. And then the featured prelim, Vince Pichel picking up a really big victory against Jim Miller in the lightweight division. A very good victory for him. He really dominated Jim Miller on the ground. And yeah, he started off a spate of people with very weird mustaches in on this show. We had him, we had John Anik and Junior Dos Santos all looking like they're doing a Magnum PI impression.
No shame, all
that. So the main card, we had five fights. Started in the bantamweight with one of the fights I would say didn't live up to the hype at all. John Dodson versus Merab Dvalishvili. And it's a shame, really, because I think Merab is a really, really talented fighter. And Dodson, obviously, we know him as someone who challenged DJ so many times and really pushed DJ to his very, very best. It just seemed like this John Dodson didn't want to come to fight. And it was pretty much three rounds of him kind of avoiding the kind of the combat. When Dvalishvili, who's skill base is wrestling, when he went for takedowns, Dodson was amazing at kind of avoiding. I think that altogether throughout the three rounds, Dvalishvili threw 20 attempts at a takedown and only actually secured two or three, and they were in the later rounds. But the issue again is, like I said, this was not the Dodson that we remember. There was no kind of aggression from him at all. It was literally just trying to avoid fighting at all times, kind of reminiscent of the Houston Alexander fight when he fought Kimbo Slice, where he just didn't want to engage at all. Fair play to Merab. He really tried to push the pace, really tried to kind of to get the fight going, but you could see he was getting frustrated, and that's when he went for more and more takedowns. But yeah, the three rounds were boring, to be fair, because there was just no action. It was literally just people, Dodson avoiding Merab and Merab trying to get that engagement and just not being able to be successful in it. Merab picked up a very clear, unanimous decision, which was absolutely on the money. I'm just disappointed at how Dodson really went into this fight. I kind of don't understand the game plan. There was nothing in his approach that said he wanted to even attempt the win at all. It was just kind of, he wanted to survive 15 minutes and get out there with a paycheck, which is a bit weird. But Merab picked up a good victory. I think he's now something like 5-2 in the UFC, really getting a bit of steam going. And yeah, there were talks about him kind of pushing right up those bantamweight rankings. And I think this fight probably will do that. I think Dodson was 12th ranked and he was like 15th ranked, so it will help him rise up there, maybe to get a top 10 opponent next time.
Well, the guy you just fought, obviously, Vieira, he just beat Sean O'Malley, which Merab, he was on about, actually.
We'll definitely get to that.
Merab was on about wanting to fight O'Malley. But the one thing about Merab is he come from Long Island. He come from Reigns, Jim. Incredible fighters have come out along with MMA in the last couple of years. Obviously, you've got Alaia Quinta, you've got Aljamain Sterling, now you've got Merab. You've got fighters coming out each time. I would have spoken to a friend of mine, Tom, obviously, because obviously Tom trains at Black Knights with me. He's a fighter himself, and he's been following Merab for years. And last night when he were on, he sent me a message saying, oh, look up this guy called Jamie something. I'll post his name on the Twitter account. But Jamie something, a guy who also fights with trains with Merab and Aljamain, who's going to be in the UFC soon. And so there's fresh talent for. So my point is there. What I'm making is there's fresh talent for Merab to always build and grow, because there's that many fighters that have come out of the gym that have already competed for titles, won titles. One of the coaches there, obviously Chris Weidman, he beat the GOAT. He was the middleweight champion for a couple of years. He defended the belt like 3 or 4 times. So yeah, he's already got people there who he needs to look at and go, right, I need to do what they did, but only better. And I think he can do that. See, I've been following him for years, and this fight is, I know a lot of people might say it was boring because he goes to the decision a lot, but it's not like one of the decisions where we talk about where it's, you're going to decision and you're making nothing happen. He pushes the pace from round one to round three. Doesn't matter if he's in a 3-round fight or a 5-round fight, you will see him pushing the same pace as he does in round one than he will do in round five. That's the sort of fighter he is. He may not get the finish, but he will give you a fun shot. He will give you a fun fight.
It's just in this fight, Dodson didn't want to come to fight. It's as simple as that. And two things happen when one of the fighters isn't up for the fight. One, he'll get finished early because they'll get cleaned out. Or two, we get 3 rounds of kind of like hide and seek almost, and that's what we got.
Definitely. Well, the one thing about Dodson is obviously what we were speaking about last night is he's a lot smaller than a lot of the people in that bantamweight division, and he's not even fighting in the top 10 yet. So when he fights in the top 10 and he's fighting people who are bigger than him and who were killers, and I'm not saying Merab's not a killer, he is a killer, he knows how to fight. At the end of the day, he's not on a 5-fight win streak in the UFC for nothing. But John Dodson, he's a bit too small for that division, and that sort of killed him last night, because Marv's wrestling, the way you were able to deliver them overhands and then level change straight in for the double leg up against the cage, and that's why we've seen him able to have 20 takedowns attempts but only managed 2. Dodson's not an easy person to take down, but the fact is Merab's that good, he was able to try 20 times to take him down. And for someone who's that fast as Dodson, who people can't even touch most majority of the time, for him to set it up with hitting him first and then grabbing him, because most majority of the time, if you hit Dodson or even throw a punch at Dodson, most majority of the time he's already moved, he's out of the way. So for you to have the speed to be able to connect to his chin, level change and shoot him for his legs without him being able to move like he does, that's incredible. But in his defence, I think that's what played against him tonight. The fact is that he was a smaller guy. He was, for me, the weaker guy when it came to like the clinch work. Punches, I believe he had that. I believe he just had that power on Merab if he let his hands go. I believe he had a lot more power than him, just a little bit more power than him. But at the end of the day, he was too sceptical to let his hands go, and you can't blame him for that. With a guy like Merab, who trains with, obviously, Ray Lingard, Chris Weidman, Aljamain Sterling, Ali Quinter, but not only that, he's got Matt Serra in his corner, who's got Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. When you're a high-skilled Jiu-Jitsu expert like Matt Serra, and you are training with these, you are training these fighters on a daily basis, their ground game is going to be scarier. So I couldn't blame myself for dodging, trying to play it safe, and for trying to stop the takedowns, keep it to the feet and keep the distance. But again, we've talked about it since the beginning of like when we started doing the podcasting. Them don't make exciting farts, and them don't make you move in the divisions you're in. But for Merab, he picked up the perfect win, and for me, I'm glad he picked up the win because I wanted him to win. Puts another win in in Lingard's gym, puts another win on his record, and puts another step forward in that bantamweight division.
Yeah, absolutely makes sense. So then after that, we go into probably the biggest shock of the night. Herbert Burns taking on Daniel Pineda. Pineda, for old school UFC fans, is someone who hasn't fought for the company in like 6 years. Got the late call. I think he said he was something like 20 pounds.
He's had to fight 11 times to get back into the UFC.
Yeah. I think he take the fight on like about 6 days notice or something like that?
Yeah, I took it short notice.
And they picked up the victory, and what a victory it was. Obviously, we know Herbert Burns is someone who's got a very, very competent ground game, but this Daniel Pineda, this new kind of Daniel Pineda, he's really upped his own ground game, and he was actually able to dominate Herbert Burns on the ground, which was quite shocking to see. But that not only was he able to dominate him on the ground, he was also dominating him on the feet as well. His shots were a lot heavier. He was he just seemed to really have a lot of sting in his tagging. He landed quite a lot of those rats, and yeah, he was just able to kind of hurt Burns. And then when Burns went to his wheelhouse of takedowns, Pineda was able to scramble and reverse, and then also get a lot of top position. The first round, it was kind of there was a lot of really interesting ground game, really a lot of reversals, attempts at submissions. Pineda and Burns were kind of delivering a bit of a class on wrestling and grappling on the floor. The big difference in the two approaches, though, was when Pineda had top position, he was doing a lot of damage, especially with those punches and elbows. When Burns eventually was able to get top position and go for the kind of a Habib leg lock and kind of a crawl up the opponent's body, Pineda was able again to kind of reverse that and get it out of danger. So the first round, it was a really strong round for Pineda. Going into the second, a lot of the same things where they started trading early. Burns went for the takedown quite quick, and it got down to the floor. There was a bit of a scramble, and then ends up getting back onto the feet. A lot of punches and elbows. But when it did get down to the floor this time, Burns really did well. I think at one point he was trying to force Pineda away from the cage to not let him have that kind of solid surface to work against. But then he got back control, and then we saw a beautiful transition from Pineda, which turned that back control into a crucifix, and that was it. It was just game over. He isolated both arms, just lamped him with elbows. You could see Burns really trying to like kind of throw Pineda off, just to no avail, and Mark Smith had absolutely no choice but to call his fight off, because he was just getting reined in on elbows and punches. A quality victory, and really exciting fight to watch. Well done, Daniel Pineda, and welcome back to the UFC, man.
What did I say to you about 30 seconds before the referee stopped that fight? When you're in that crucifix position, the only thing he needs to do now is start raining down blows, because that ref has got no other choice to stop that fight,
because in the
crucifix position, you have got both hands tied down, there is no defence, you are just freely hitting that person in the brain. If that person can't get out of there, can't move, that's a technical knockout. Because if you, doesn't matter how many times you do it, you could hit him another 100 times and not knock him out. Yeah. You're going to give him damage. Simple as that. So the referee is always going to stop it. So if you're in that position, you fucking finish it there and then. Just go for it. Because at the end of the day, if you know they can't get out, the ref's going to stop it no matter what.
Well, it was in that crucifix for what? A good minute.
Definitely.
Trying to like work his way out of it, and his face was just getting absolutely demolished. With it wasn't even the punches; it was the elbows.
The elbow to the socket, and I'm like, is it orbital?
It split. It made made Burns look like both his eyes are 12. I mean, to be fair to Burns, he did damage Pineda. We saw that cut above the eye, but
knee was vicious. What cut the eye? That was a perfect counter knee from Burns.
But those shots that Pineda were laying in on that crucifix, you could literally see over that minute or so period the difference between Burns going into that crucifix and Burns coming out of it, because he looked so damaged in a minute.
Definitely. This fight all came down to stamina, because for me, these two fighters, for me, are equally skill-wise a match on the feet and on the ground. And for me, it all literally came down to who's got the better gas tank. And Daniel clearly had it last night. Obviously, in the first round, there was a massive grappling exchange. That takes a lot of cardio, a lot of strength, a lot. It takes a lot out of you. A lot of people don't. A lot of people just look at it and go, "Oh, that seems easier. Try it." It's fucking not. So it does take a lot out of you. And Burns gassed, and he got slopper in the second round. And Daniel, from going out of the UFC, from when he got cut, obviously he came in like 2012 or something like that, 13. I think he picked up two, lost three, four.
He's 4-4 now in his record.
Yeah, so it's he lost. He didn't have the best of runs when he came in. He's gone. He's had 11 fights. I don't say that as in like, oh, UFC took piss, made him having 11 fights to come back. He's chose to have them 11 fights. He's chose to go out there and get that experience. He knew that he's got cut from the UFC. He's done something wrong. He needs to change something about his game. He's gone. He's took them 11 fights. He's learnt something. He's come back. He's just finished a guy people run about. Oh, he should be basically following his brother soon about fighting for a title.
Yeah, well, Herbert Burns went into this fight, was unbeaten in the UFC 2-0, and now he's 2-1.
Exactly, so it's a guy like Daniel should. If I were Daniel, I'd be asking for another name to keep that ball rolling, because if you've done that all that work, 11 fights to get back to where you want to be, back to where you should have been when you were there 6 years ago and you got cut, if you were there and you'd beat a guy like Burns, you keep that fucking train rolling. You don't stop until that train gets derailed.
It's got the potential to do what Lando Venata did. Lando Venata was out in the wilderness, came back, took a last minute fight on a one fight contract, and 2 years on, he's had about 6 or 7 UFC fights. So he's got that potential there. It's just good to see him back and good to see him still hungry.
Definitely, and also one good. I don't know if it is true, but like I said to you last night, obviously he's come in. He's got his show money. He's got his win bonus. I don't know if he's got his 25% of Burns. Burns weighed him £3 over. I don't know if he's got a finishing bonus.
He said in the post fight interview with Joe Rogan, Joe Rogan was like totting up how much he'd made on it, and he was just like, "Well, hey."
The guy's fucking after this, literally from getting cut to coming back to beating a guy on short notice on actually getting a finish is phenomenal. That Dana White will be looking at him thinking to himself, like, if he's stayed on this route, I have got another champion on my hands. Simple as that. And he did. He looked like a champion. He looked like he needed to do. He took some shots. He had adversity, and he were able to overcome it. And he were able to see. He were able to see Herbert slipping and getting lazy on the feet. And when he was about to basically get comfortable and go into the transition to the full mount, he's like, "Fuck that! I've saw the crucifix here. He got slippy. He's not even defending it." He slipped straight into it, and he knew exactly what to do, and he took the finish and took the victory.
Right on to the middle of the main card now with the heavyweight bout, Junior Dos Santos versus Jairzinho Rozenstruik. Jairzinho obviously trying to come back off that devastating whooping from Francis Ngannou, trying to kind of get that momentum back going. And it worked. It really did work. Junior Dos Santos, obviously former champion, and it's sad to say how much that guy has fallen off from being an absolute killer going into like the Cain Velasquez and Brock Lesnar eras to basically what he is now. First round, though, to be fair, I actually gave it to Dos Santos. I felt, even though he was very nervy, and I think even Rozenstruik was quite nervy, there was not a lot of action going into like the later minutes of this round. It was more Dos Santos wanting to keep Rozenstruik at bay, because once he hits you with a shot, he's going to hurt you. He proved that against Overeem. So Dos Santos kept him at bay with long rangey jabs and the leg kicks and the front kicks. There was a couple of times in this round where both fighters ended up kicking their opponent in the nuts. The one at the end where it literally kicked him in the nuts. They took about a 2 minute break, and then as soon as they started the fight again, the round was over. But going back into this round, it was pretty much Dos Santos kind of controlling the pace, staying out of Rozenstruik's way, throwing the kicks. When Rozenstruik caught kicks and kind of had his own attack, Dos Santos did well to evade. Didn't really get caught that much in the round, to be fair. But then going into the second round, Rozenstruik looked a little bit more lively. Like he kind of used that first round to weigh up what Dos Santos's game plan was. Dos Santos kind of also got a little bit more braver with his shots. He was willing to get more into like action with Rozenstruik. But Rozenstruik started really pushing the pace, throwing the leg kicks, and you could see how he was kind of putting more kind of stank into him. So they were hurting Dos Santos a lot more. Dos Santos tried to do some body work, landed a couple of clean rights. Rozenstruik countered with the kicks. I think Rozenstruik could sense that there was going to be some time when he was able to throw those bombs, and it was just kind of a sensible fight. He didn't get forced into a battle that he wasn't ready for. He just waited, picked his shots. He started, like I said, he was throwing more stank in those leg kicks, and there were a point where he stumbled Dos Santos. Dos Santos started to kind of get worried, but the end came really when Rozenstruik was able to kind of corner Dos Santos, almost get him up against the fence. Dos Santos tried to escape. He got clipped with a right, gets dropped. Rozenstruik pounces, lands a lot of punches. Dos Santos was just absolutely away with the fairies. Tried to regain his composure and survive. Rozenstruik was not having that. Took the punches. In comes the ref, Dan Mergliotto, waved it off, and a good comeback victory for Rozenstruik. Get another win back in that win column, pushing himself back into contention.
Definitely. Don't forget Rozenstruik. When I said it in the first round, I thought he was obviously a gun shy. Not long just being knocked out by Francis. You don't want to come back and run into a guy like JDS, especially early in the fight, because early in the fight, a not tired JDS will knock you out.
It's an elite level boxer.
Definitely. So I think Rozenstruik played it perfectly in that first round. Yeah, even though I believe that I would give that first round to JDS, Rozenstruik used it perfectly to just tap him in the leg, keep his distance, tap him in the leg. Then at the end of the round one, going into the round two, when Rozenstruik actually got hit a couple of times and felt the power, I think in his head it's like, right, I'm getting that confidence back now, because I've been able to take his leg away a bit, his front leg, so we can't put as much pressure on it, so we can't put as much power into that right hand and knock me out. I think that did work for him, and when he did get it with that right hand, I think obviously he knew, I can take that, I've damaged his leg enough, I've weakened him, I can take that shot.
And let's go in for the kill.
Basically, yeah, I've got more confidence, I can feel that, I can, because he's a counterfighter a lot more. We've seen it a lot when Dominic Cruz even said it, like, when a lot of people know that he got knocked out, but before he did get knocked out, he still landed that left hook on Francis. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the best moves that he's knocked people out with, especially that right hook as well. We see it against Overeem when he knocked him out.
Well, it took five rounds of whippings from Overeem, so we know he's got a chin.
Oh yeah,
but
definitely.
He's also he only needs that one shot, and it kind of proved it in this fight, because it was one big shot that did the damage, and he just followed it up.
Definitely, that one big swing in the right hand, and that's another thing that's fun about the heavyweight division. Don't matter who you are, a lot of people think that, I think this guy's going to win, I know this guy's going to win. It's like, that heavyweight division is just raw power. You get hit once, don't matter who it is, you get hit once, they've got the potential to put your lights out.
Yep.
That's why sometimes I love watching the heavyweight division, because you just physically do not know who is going to take that. Sometimes you just do not know who's going to take that fight. It could literally be anyone's fight, and this was that fight tonight. This was anybody's fight. Like we said, we saw JDS get the better of the stand-up in round one. Then coming into the round two, Rozenstruik opened up, he got more confident on his feet, he got more gun happy, he was able to get his shots off, and as soon as he saw his opening, he took it, he went straight in, he saw the right hand there, and he hit Dos Santos with it, and he hurt him, and as soon as Dos Santos has turned his back, he jumped on him. Now, I believe if DeSantis didn't turn his back and just covered up, I believe he would have been able to use his boxing and his head movement to get out of there. That's one thing that I hate about people turning the back on their opponent, especially if you get hurt. I know it's sometimes a little bit... It's hard for me to say because obviously when you get rocked, your brain's a bit all over the place. You sort of lose your sense of direction for a minute. You sort of don't know which way is up or down or left or right. So you can... I can understand obviously people doing it, but obviously when you're someone like Junior Dos Santos who's been in them sort of situations before, who's been practicing that sort of stuff, you'd think in them situations that he'd be able to sort of react a little bit differently, sort of be able to like absorb it, shit, I'm hurt, cover up, do everything I need to do, rather than shit, I'm panic, fuck it, let's run, he's going to knock me out. But that's what we saw, and I believe if he didn't do that, I mean, that fight could have gone on a little bit longer. Do never turn your back on your opponent.
Yeah, it's daft, and we actually saw that in the main event right at the end. I mean, it wasn't as significant. But even Bones like commented on it about if there's 2 seconds left in the fight, why are you walking away? If that's anyone else, you catch hands. And in fact, it wasn't long ago we saw a fight where someone was walking away, 7 seconds
to go. Guy got clocked, fucking went over and cracked him. Which
you don't do. You fight to the bell. Going into the core main event and the biggest kind of shock in terms of an underdog winning, not to people who know about MMA. A lot of people were kind of writing off Marlon Vera, which is a dangerous thing to do because that guy is a little pit bull, and he was facing Sean O'Malley, the latest one of Dana's kind of hyped up young kids with an immense amount of raw talent, but maybe being pushed a little bit too soon. And this fight kind of proves that. It wasn't that long ago that O'Malley actually fought. And then when he came into this fight, me and Carlos both commented on the fact he had the ankle supports on, which to me signifies that he had an injury going into this fight. Now, is this the fault of him wanting to kind of keep his momentum going, or is it the fault of UFC pushing him before he's ready, not allowing him to pick up the injuries and kind of capitalising on the notoriety of him, obviously with him being a very outspoken fighter with his massive clown wig? Were UFC kind of maybe not so much worried about his health and fitness, but just wanting to make more money off his name? Who's to say? For me, he's going down the Sage Northcutt rule road, where he's got massive amounts of potential, potentially a world champion, but he's still very young and still very raw. And I think sometimes UFC have got this habit of getting big names, really pushing behind them when they're not quite ready, and then when the kind of heart train like derails, tossing them aside. We've seen it with Paige VanZant, we've seen it with Sage Northcutt, we've seen it with countless fighters where once they start losing, I mean, you could even say potentially with Darren Till, once he started losing, he kind of like tumbled down the card a little bit, and this is what I fear for Sean O'Malley. But getting into the fight, we instantly thought there's something suspicious there with him having two ankle supports on. He started off quite fresh, a little bit nervy, which, like I said, against Marlon Vera, you should be nervy because that guy, he is an animal. People have wrote him off in this fight and they should never have done that. But O'Malley was throwing kicks, both to the legs and the body. Vera was switching stance a lot, which kind of said that the kicks were hurting him. But the big change in the fight came when O'Malley was trying to move forward, and you could see where he rolled his ankle. Now the commentary didn't pick up on it in the fight, and a lot of the actual press on MMA Twitter didn't pick up on the roll. They kind of suspected it was his knee. No, it was definitely his ankle. When they showed the replay after the fight, you can literally see where his toes dug into the canvas, and his ankle literally just rolled over. He did really well to try and hide the fact that he had an injury, but you Vera knew it were there. We knew it were there. He couldn't put any weight on it. He took a lot of kicks to it because of that. He was brave enough to actually throw some kicks with the same leg, but that was kind of his downfall. He threw a kick with the leg, and as he like tried to kind of like plant his feet back, he fell back because that foot just gave away, that ankle gave away. He fell down. Vera got on top, just started laying in punches and elbows. You could just hear the pain that O'Malley was in. Herb Dean did well to stop it. Potentially, you could say it was a bit early because O'Malley was not really kind of taking a lot of damage, and he wasn't like getting knocked out. But you could see that Herb knew there was no getting up. He couldn't stand up on that leg. It showed even after the fight in the result that he was struggling to stand on the leg. And the minute Bruce Buffer announced that Marlon Vera had won the fight, Sean O'Malley was out on a stretcher. That kid has got a major, major problem with his ankle. Hopefully, he'll come back well. Nobody likes to see anyone get a severe long-term injury. So hopefully, it's as small an injury as it can be. But great victory for Marlon Vera. And yeah, just back to the drawing board for Sean O'Malley and possibly for UFC in terms of hyping these young kids that clearly aren't ready.
Definitely. At 25 years of age, his heart train, as my personal opinion, has not been derailed. It's just been sent on a sent on a different route. He will come back. He's 25. He will come back. It's just a thing you've got to overcome. Obviously, there is a line in injury there with his ankle. In his last fight, he injured it. Obviously, now he's injured it, and you don't wear ankle support for no reason. If you've got healthy ankles and that, like, you have no reason to wear them. And obviously, he does a lot of kicking. And so when you do a lot of kicking and you do initial damage, like even if it's the micro fractures or just little tears in your like ligaments from kicking all the time. But obviously, these professional athletes are training 5-6 days a week. And then obviously when they're in the fight camps, they're in the fight camps training 7 days a week for a month, 2 months. So you're always going to get initial damage. Not one fighter comes into a fight at 100%. I'd be surprised if a fighter does come into a fight at 100%. Because if they do come into a fight at 100%,
they haven't
pushed themselves hard enough. Or they've got the fucking best sort of training regime out there and they need to get everyone on it because they'll make a fucking fortune. But yeah, no fighter comes into a fight at 100%. And when you've got an injury with your ankles, with your knees, with your back, and it actually stops you from performing, that's the sort of shit you need to think, oh, I need to sort it out now, otherwise I'm going to lose and lose fast, constantly, and my career is going to take a turn for the worse if he doesn't sort it out. But not taking nothing away from Vera, he checked a kick, and he knew, because again, he's a kicker himself, so he knows, he knows how people's hips move. It's like going back into the last fight, like Dos Anjos. He was fighting a lot less like onwards, like a boxer. He was fighting a lot more sideways on, like at any point he were about to spin and do like a heel hook or something like that. He was fucking spinning shit. But yeah, O'Malley were like, he stands like that, and Vera knows as soon as a kick's coming, he knows exactly what to do, how to check a kick, how to move out the way. And he was able to not only check the kick and see the initial damage before everybody else. If you actually noticed about Vera, which were one of the perfect things, he started moving to the left. Now, Sean O'Malley's obviously, did Sean really throw out for his left foot? Which foot were it?
His right foot.
Vera actually started moving to his right because it's fucking left. His left foot. He's actually started moving to his left because when Vera knew that he's hurt his leg there, if I walk this way, I'm not walking onto the power side. I'm not walking on to where he can catch me with his full power. I know if I walk this way, and we've seen it, he walked to the left and he took a couple of kicks off O'Malley. But we seen them kicks weren't doing nothing because that leg were hurt. It's just, Vera knew, if he walked the other way, O'Malley, he'd be able to kick him with the other leg. But yeah, fair enough, it'd have to be a short kick because he won't be able to put a lot of pressure on that leg straight away. We seen it, when he put pressure on that leg, he ended up falling down if he put too much pressure on it. But if Vera actually walked the other way and give O'Malley that chance to get them quick, snappy shots off, he'd be able to put pressure on the leg and get enough time to to kick him and bring his leg back down. But because Ferreira used his fart level IQ and knew he's injured here, if I go to this side and just keep picking at him and picking at him, this fart's mine. And eventually he did. He made O'Malley beat himself. He made O'Malley keep having to put pressure on that leg. Because when he was moving that way, O'Malley switched stances. And he was trying to bounce about and actually go the opposite way to what Ferreira were going. So he could try and switch Ferreira's game up so that Ferreira started going back to his like, ordinary game plan. But again, Ferreira's too smart for that. He stuck to his game plan. He knew he's hurt. I've got to injure Gazelle here and I'm a lion. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to fuck this time for feeding him. I know he's injured. I'm not going to let him get away. I'm not going to do anything wrong because I want to eat. Simple as that. And that's what Ferreira did. He knew if he kept on going that way, he'd make the Gazelle outrun itself and make itself tired. And it'd be an easy meal for him. And it did. Sean O'Malley had to go on that leg. And as soon as he fell down, he just knew the pain hit him. The pain hit him straight away when he fell down. He physically couldn't stand up. If he wanted to stand up, he would have stand up. If Ferreira wanted to let him up, he could have easily let him up. But at that point, Herb would have already stopped it because the doctor would have come in and said, hang on a minute, you've probably brought your leg there, you've probably brought your foot, this fart's over. So Ferreira jumped on top and got the finish. He could have easily stopped it there and took the doctor stoppage, but no, what looked better, doctor stoppage or a finish?
Exactly.
He dove straight in, and yeah, a lot of people might say it was an early stoppage, but that initial elbow, when you actually go and see it, O'Malley were out for about a second or two there. But as soon as he took that elbow, you seen him stiffen up.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he went back in the game, because you seen him, he stiffened up, he took the elbow, and then it was like 2 seconds, he covered up. Like when Herb Dean just about to got back in, so it was like, he didn't know that was Herb Dean. I guarantee you that, he didn't know. In 2 seconds, I guarantee he fought Herb Dean where he were over the top of him, I guarantee he fought even fucking Ferreira, still about to fucking finish him off with more fucking punches, because there's no way, you don't cover up like that for nothing. If you, yeah. When you wake up and you like you see someone over, it's like, oh shit. Like, if you knew who that were, Herb Dean, you know that he's a ref, you know he's not going to fucking ground and pound you, so you won't, there's no need to cover up. Exactly. He covered up because he was out, and Herb Dean is that good of a referee. Obviously, going back to Mirab, he's one of these training guys. Jamie, I shared a video on my Facebook. Jamie snapped someone's fucking arm. He literally, he nearly ripped it off. The guy didn't tap, and the ref didn't stop the fight. Jamie actually let go and walked away, shouting, I fucking snapped his arm. He let go, the guy's arm was wobbling. The referee didn't even see it, and it was like, how did you not see something like that? But that's what Herb seen as soon as O'Malley fell down, and as soon as O'Malley took that shot, he's high level IQ at being a referee and saving these fighters. He's seen not only can O'Malley not stand because he's potentially got a broken foot, O'Malley's just got knocked out there for a second, so now potentially he's got a concussion. So not only has he got a damaged leg, he's got a concussion, he's going to have his 9-day suspension, he's going to have to go and have a CAT scan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he started. It was not, for me, that it were a perfect stoppage,
yeah,
and a perfect victory for Marlon Ferreira. He's an animal, he's been an animal since 2014. I know he's lost a couple of fights, and I know he's been in decision, but you tell me the last fight, he's been in a boring fight. He's always one of them who's pushed the pace. He's always one of them who's come to fight, willing to fight. Like, look at his last fight against Song Yadong, who he absolutely whooped the piss out of and then got robbed.
Yeah, that was a horrific decision.
It's like, I can't remember the last time he's been in a boring fight. And again, tonight against a guy who everyone were behind, everyone was saying he was the next big thing, you just took his train away. And again, he finished it off with a perfect promo at the end as well. When he jumped on the cage, you know what they say? Welcome to the Ferreira Show. To Dana or something. So stealing O'Malley's stuff, perfect. It's like Chael Sonnen said afterwards on the ESPN Live. Brad Okamura, when he turned to Chael, he went, I don't have to tell you, you're a guy like that. He said, but even he finished the promo off perfectly. Obviously, after when he beat him, he jumped on the cage, he stole his punchline and said to Dana what O'Malley said to him basically in Contender Series. So not only has he got the fight IQ, he's also got the promoter IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And if he stays that way, he's going to go a long way. But before we move on as well, I want to say about O'Malley, about when he was actually in the weigh-ins, there were people saying he was shaking on the stage, because making that cut, he is a big bantamweight. Yeah, I guarantee he does cut a good 15, maybe 16 pounds to get to that weight, and it might not seem a lot, but when you're already small enough as it is to cut more and more weight, it can fucking drain on you. We've seen it with Max when he's fighting at featherweight and stuff. So I believe we do see O'Malley come back. I just believe we see him come back at featherweight rather than bantamweight.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. I agree with you in the fact that I don't think it's a kind of a derailment of the heart train. I think it's just, if this fight didn't have that ankle injury, it possibly could have gone another way. From that round, you can't tell whether O'Malley would have won that fight, because it was just not enough action. That ankle injury was clearly the significant difference in that fight. So, yeah, hopefully, like I said, he recovers quickly. He gets himself 100% fit, or at least strengthens those ankles, because there is weak
well,
right now.
Going up a weight will strengthen, that's what I mean. But when I say going up a weight, I don't mean that because he's not only big. Going up a weight will mean that he'll have the chance to put an extra 10 pounds of muscle on, put an extra 12 pounds of muscle on, so he can actually still strengthen his... It's all to do with strength and condition. The more muscle mass you've got, and the more strength you've got, the better it is for your body. And obviously, with him being a fighter, he'll be taking the right nutrition and that to keep his bones healthy. Obviously, there's not a lot of nutrition apart from that protein and obviously getting your rest and recovering to work your muscles. But him moving up a weight will give him that more strength and conditioning to not get these silly little injuries where it's going over on his ankle. Because and a lot of people might think of it, but we've got 26 bones in our feet, 26 tiny little bones that make up both of our feet. And that's one of the things since evolution that's basically fucked us over. It's out of our back teeth, we don't need them. Like, our ankles are made up of 26 little bones, so they're already weak as it is. You can go over them at any point. So now you imagine being a fighter and doing all the movements and basically being on the... being on a slippy canvas where people have been farting, stuff's been sprayed on it, and getting sweaty yourself, you're going to go over on your ankle. So it's all a case of he just needs to go back and just do a bit of strength and conditioning, and hopefully he gets back to 90%, if not 100%, just 90% will do.
Mm-hmm. So let's go into what this fight was, this card was built around, the trilogy fight against Stipe Miocic and Daniel Cormier, both guys coming in with a victory apiece. This was the rubber match. Stipe coming in as the champion. And to be fair, he got a fairly decisive victory. He picked up the victory by decision. First round, I felt it was Cormier's round. This was really the only round that Cormier tried to do any wrestling. He did well in terms of getting his opponent on the floor. Miocic looked very, very nervy in this first round. He looked kind of like he couldn't gauge Cormier. He used a lot of like little tappy leg kicks, which really didn't do any damage. And Cormier, he was very, very confident in this first round. He was able to kind of control the middle of the cage. Stipe kind of going around the outside. When he went in for the takedown, he was able to get it. Stipe did well to kind of like get back to his feet, but Cormier was also able to throw more shots. There was a bit of a break in this round when Cormier caught Miocic with an eye poke, which gets more significant later on in the fight when it comes to Cormier. And you could see that really hurt Miocic's eye, instantly swelled, went red, and you could see the cut on the inside of the eyelid. But Miocic, getting to the back end of this fight, the last few seconds, did land a few of his own shots, but Cormier did... He did enough to win that first round, I thought, and really give Miocic something to think about. Going into the second round, and we saw a bit more of a braver Miocic. He did well. He faked a takedown to land a couple of shots. he was able to throw more punches, and this is when he really started to out-throw Miocic and out-throw Cormier in terms of significant strikes. And even in that first round, when I said that Cormier won it, if you go off just significant strikes, Miocic actually landed the more shots. It's just that Cormier's had more sting about him, and he also had that kind of wrestling, that couple of minutes of like control of wrestling, which really like tipped them to balance. And to be fair to all the first, maybe at least the first two rounds in the fourth round, they quite razor thin, and you could easily have an argument to say either fighter won it. But I give the second round to Miocic just because he kind of turned it up a little bit in terms of landing shots, and there was a point where he tagged Cormier, and you could see that it really hurt Cormier. Cormier looked like he was concussed straight away. I tried to do a bit of evasion, did a spinning back fist there whilst he was evading, which landed on Miocic, but Miocic just followed him up and tagged him again, got him, basically knocked him to the floor. And if it wasn't for Cormier able to grip hold of Miocic in on the ground and stop him like laying those punches, and then just surviving that like 15 seconds till the bell went, I think that fight would have finished in the second round. Then going into the third, I felt that Cormier was still dazed when he came into this third. He really looked punch drunk. But Miocic just didn't do enough to kind of pressurise it, and he allowed Cormier to kind of regather his thoughts and kind of recover. But he still was able to land shots. He just weren't damaging enough to kind of capitalise on Cormier's Cormier's clear like mental, I don't want to say deficiency, but his brain was scrambled, and Miocic didn't do enough to capitalise on that. Once Cormier did recover, he was able to swing back and kind of go for the takedown, but Miocic was able to stuff that. And then whilst we get to the middle of the round, Miocic was able to start pushing Cormier up against the fence, and this is where, for me, Miocic won this fight. He was able to control a very elite level wrestler in Daniel Cormier against the fence, using his shoulders and when he was able to get his hands free, the punches, and using the main weapon was the double underhooks. He was able to control Cormier up against the cage and really kind of like stuff Cormier's attack. In this round, we had a little bit of a irony from Cormier when he made a massive complaint about Stipe Miocic poking him in the eye, which Miocic did poke him in the eye. It was clearly accidental.
I believe they call that a present in our gym. Basically, if you kick someone in bollocks or poke someone in the eye, just expect your present to come back.
Yeah, well, a receipt, it's called, basically.
Well, that's in America.
Yeah, but if you take all the fights that these guys have had, Cormier's poked Miocic in the eye, it must be a half a dozen times at least. Like I said, he poked him in the first round, and no one's saying they're doing it on purpose, but this eye poke was way more significant because it's literally blinded Cormier. Cormier said after the fight that from the moment he got that eye poke, he could not see out of that eye.
It was just a black screen.
And we're up to press, we've not heard anything about whether he's got his vision back in that. So hopefully that's something that does happen. But again, it was another fight where Miocic controlled, another round where Miocic controlled DC and was able to pick up that round. Fourth round, again, a lot of the same. It was Miocic scoring good shots, able to clinch with Cormier, slowly bully him up against the fence, and control him there. In this round, Cormier was able to kind of like circle away and did land a couple of shots on the way out. But it was this was probably the best round for Cormier since the first round. But again, it was so razor thin, you could easily say that either fighter took it. Then going into the fifth round, it was just Miocic turned it up because he knew he was potentially winning on the card. Cormier just had nothing left in the gas tank, I don't think. I mean, there was the talk of him being really kind of like built, really kind of lost some weight and being ripped for this fight. But when it come to actual fight time, he piled that those poundages back on, and he was, you could tell he was kind of like tired and going for like basically going to. It was in like desperation mode, throwing wild shots. Obviously, he was struggling with the arse, so he was circling towards the opposite side, and Miocic was able to kind of like use that target to make sure he was landing enough shots to win the round. He got in up against the cage, landing some good knees. We thought that the fight would end up getting finished, but it got to the end. Miocic picked up, for me, a quite decisive victory. I gave him 4-1. Two of the judges agreed with me. One of the judges gave it 3-2. And, yeah, it's the end of an era, really. Daniel Cormier has lost this trilogy. If he comes back, the only potential fight is really the other trilogy, which is already lost because he's 2-0 down. Daniel Cormier, after the fight... Said it was over for him. He's not interested in any kind of fights or a title shot, which at his stage of his career you can understand, but when you've lost twice in a row to the champion, you can't expect another title shot. So great victory for Stipe. Very exciting to see what's in his future, and a sad way to end it for someone like Daniel Cormier. But as much as I've kind of been on and off the Cormier bandwagon in terms of like supporting him and then not supporting him, the guy's give his life to combat sports, and yeah. I can't give nothing but praise for someone who is broke barriers for people in MMA. So yeah, thanks for everything, Daniel. If you ever do listen to this, we will always appreciate what you brought to the show. But yeah, great victory for Stipe.
Definitely. But on Daniel, win, lose, or draw, he'll always be a great ambassador for the sport, no matter what he does. If he decides to come back, which hopefully I don't want him to, but like I said to you, I don't believe him when he's saying he's going to stay retired. UFC throws in too much money to take that third fight with Bond. But yeah, with Stipe, what a fantastic game plan. Letting DC and letting everybody believe that he's just going to go straight back to the body when he knew perfectly he was going to go for double underhooks, because that's what I didn't understand in the first two fights, when I seen it in this fight I thought, yeah, he's worked on it there, his coaches have gone on it, because in his first two fights with him he didn't go for the double unders, he was only going for like the one under, one over and stuff like that. Daniel were able to get out of it now. When you're the bigger guy. And it clearly shows that as well, that Stipe has been doing nothing but train on his wrestling defence and his takedown defence and just his wrestling, his grappling, all in all. Because DC could not take him down. Even if he tried, he could not take him down. Stipe was not allowing that room or not doing anything sloppy to take him down. He did it in the first round.
And then after that, he pretty much gave up on it because it wasn't going to happen.
He knew, and I do believe with Stipe losing the weight, losing a bit of the weight and being a bit faster, I do believe DC had that game plan to come and wrestle fuck him, because that's what me and Mars were talking about. We were on about what do you think is going to happen. Mars were on about him coming in and just wrestle fucking him for 5 rounds, and I'm like, I don't know, mate. I don't believe him. I think he's saying that to show people it, but Daniel Cormier wanting to go out, wanting to win that title, wanting to go out as the best. He went, you don't want to go out winning that title. People say, no, he only won it because he wrestled fucked you for 5 rounds. What a boring fight. He was trying to knock Stipe out. He was trying to do everything. Them shots that he was trying to hit Stipe with, them just swinging them over and right. He wanted to knock Stipe out. He wanted to knock him out and take that title that way. So people didn't have the chance to say, no, you're not the best heavyweight in the world because you had to wrestle fuck him and you had to hug him for 5 rounds. He wanted to knock you out so he could. So people say that, yeah, you are the best, because I don't believe he lost that fight. You know, I know he lost the fight, but as when it goes to moral victories, his last fight of the career, people will look at that and look at him as a winner. Because, yeah, he might not have wrestled fucked him, yeah, he might have lost, but at the end of the day, that was one of the fucking most exciting heavyweight fights that has been. And that's what people remember. People won't remember the fact is, oh, he lost by unanimous decision. It'd be, he near enough fucking, because he rocked, he rocked Stipe twice.
Mm-hmm.
Twice, he rocked him. He hurt him. And I believe his game plan were to wrestle him. But after that first round, when Stipe was just showing him that, I'm too strong for you now, I'm stronger than you, you're not going to hold me down, because you've been able to take me down when I'm up straight like that. And I believe DC felt that. DC felt his energy. DC felt his strength. DC felt, shit, I know I'm not going to be able to hold this guy down. He's bigger than me. He's got good, even though Daniel Cormier is amazing at wrestling, if you've got good takedown defense and decent wrestling yourself, there is not much what an elite wrestler can do to you. Because at the end of the day, if you know how to defend a lot of the stuff, yeah, as long as you're not offensive with it and putting yourself into stupid positions where DC can reverse them, as long as you're just constantly being defensive, 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 even if DC were to take you down, you're probably going to end up getting stood up because DC can't work. And that's what DC felt. As soon as he took him down, Stipe just stopped him straight away, stopped him from being able to advance. And as soon as he stopped him from being able to advance, straight back to his feet, straight back to the clinch, straight back to the double unders. Because when you're the taller fighter, you'd be stupid not to do the double unders, because that's what helped him in this fight a lot, the double unders and the cage work. Because in the first fight, again, he went one under, one over. DC were able to get out of it. He's the bigger opponent. Now, if you imagine someone who's bigger than you and you're stood up and they've got their arms under, your arms are up here. So when you're stood up, you're having to fight more to get your arms down. Stipe only has to stand there with his hands clinched just underneath you. He's already the bigger guy. He's there basically making you go on your tiptoes, which is making you having to not only carry your own weight, having to fight yourself out of that position. I believe Stipe did the game plan that DC was going to do to Stipe. Hold him, make him carry Stipe's weight, and make him carry his own weight and tire him out. And I believe that's what he did do. He did tire DC out. And obviously the eye poke, yeah, people can say that played in Stipe's favour. But at the end of the day, did it not play in DC's favour in the second fight when he poked him in eye about 8 times? Did it not play in DC's favour in the first fight when he poked him in eye before he won and stuff?
And then in this fight when he poked him in the first round?
Exactly. So them pros and cons to the game at the end of the day. There's always something like that going to happen. And when you've done it to your opponent so many times, unfortunately, you can't come in and complain about it when you get it done to you. If you play dirty, you're going to get someone who's going to play dirty back. It's as simple as that. You know, it's all about respect. People are going to show you the respect you give them. Yeah, you might be punching them in the face, but if you do something dirty to them, that's respect that they've lost for you. They're going to want to fucking give you that back. At the end of the day, you give them a present. You want to return the present. At the end of the day, it's only fair. But yeah, DC, as soon as he felt Stipe's strength and being able to realise, hang on a minute, I'm not going to be able to like hold him down here. Shit, I'm fucking stuck here. Just fucking swing for the fences. Because there were no... Fair enough, his jabs, a couple of jabs that were setting him up, but look at actually how he was swinging them. It was just fucking wild swinging that right hand, just hopefully catching Stipe when he goes down. But then again, Stipe, he could have... I don't know, understand why he wasn't throwing that left hook when he was going down, because DC has always got that habit of going down to the right, going down to the right, going down to the right, and that's how Bones got him with that head kick. And I know he's a lot easier to not hit his head because he's got a weird way of moving his head, but as soon as you put your head down to the right, it's always open. And I know he sometimes uses that to coax you in. But when you're the bigger guy with an 8-inch reach advantage, that hook is open all day long for you. Same with that high kick. And we only saw Stipe actually throw a high kick. I think it was in the 4th or the 5th round when DC were going down to the right. Because if you remember, he literally only threw one that went past the actual fucking midsection.
Yeah.
Now, if he were doing that in the beginning, DC wouldn't have been going down to there a lot more. Because he would have been thinking, fuck, he's already caught me there. That's a game plan I'm going to have to change right now. The bad habits that his last fight, like I said to you, Why are you going to work on bad habits if it's your last fight? You're going to work on trying to win. You're going to work on trying to knock this guy out and fucking win. That's why it worked. And that's why he poked him in the arse straight away. Because it's a bad habit that his coaches aren't going to waste time working on. Because if his coaches knew that this was his last fight, deep down this was his last fight, his coaches are working on getting DC that belt. His coaches aren't working on, oh, DC, you've got to do this to play fair, to make the fans do this. Fuck, okay, everybody, it's your last fight. It's your last fight to get a belt. You try and get that belt. Fuck everything else. But again, not to take anything away from Stipe. Stipe were able to go in there tonight, win the trilogy, and show everyone why he is the best heavyweight in the world. A two-time heavyweight champion, defended the belt four times, more times than anybody else. All he needs to do is lose it again, fucking pick it back up and defend it again, and he's held the belt more times than Randy Couture. He's defended the belt more times than anybody else in that division. Who else is Stipe left to beat in that division to say he is the all-time greatest heavyweight champion, unless obviously going on to if Bones goes up. Well, he's beat,
let's get on to that.
That's it. Stipe has beat Francis Ngannou, he's beat DC, he's beat Vadum, he's beat JDS. Stipe has beat everybody put in front of him. What's next for Stipe, the greatest heavyweight champion? Well,
we both know that Bones was live tweeting this far, very much hinting that he wanted to move up. I've said to a couple of friends on Twitter and also to Carl, personally, I think Bones is the harder fight for Stipe, because in this fight with DC, he looked vulnerable to clinch fighting. He looked vulnerable to people coming in with in and out 1-2 combinations. And he also looked vulnerable to counter striking, which is three of the biggest tools in Bones' arsenal. But Dana has also kind of reacted to Bones' tweeting and said that there's no way that they step over Francis again. He said that Francis has had a lot of fights where he's been overlooked and kind of like just been the wrong person in the wrong time for a title shot. So Dana said that Francis is next, whether Bones moves up or not. So are we going to see Bones kind of finish off that kind of rubber stamp his legacy in the lightweight division by finishing Reyes and then moving up, or does he drop the title, wait and just wait for the winner of Ngannou and Miocic? We'll see. But the hints are that Bones is moving up very, very soon. There's a lot of call for the Reyes fight. People were obviously saying that Reyes beat him in the last fight. I don't believe that he did. I felt that Bones won that fight. And if you remember all the times that Bones has had a rematch with someone when they've claimed that maybe they're the best of him, they got the best of him, he comes back and he takes all doubt out of the equation. Did it with Gustafsson. People were saying, yeah, Gustafsson beat him. He came back and he dominated him. Did it against DC when he dominated DC in the second fight. It's very likely that Bones just turns it up again against Reyes and finishes that fight and then moves on. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting next couple of fights for that kind of three-way between Bones and Ngannou and Stipe. So it'll be fun to see where that goes.
Definitely. Speaking on that lines, we've got all the likes of John Jones, Francis Ngannou, Stipe Miocic and Dominic Reyes. With all them lot in the wings to fight each other, anything could happen over the last couple of weeks, so stay tuned in the Five Rounds podcast and we'll keep you updated over the next couple of weeks to see what comes out of all this.
After we kind of broke MMA news last week, mentioning the fact that Yoel Romero and Uriah Hall's fight had been quietly taken off the card, and then it broke a few days later that it was because Yoel Romero was ill. Next week's card is a weak looking card on paper, but we've always said that these kind of weak looking cards, they're full of fighters who want to make a name for themselves, and it give for more exciting fights. So really, there's two big fights. Well, one big fight and one big name fighter in a fight. So the main event is Frankie Edgar taking on Pedro Munhoz in that bantamweight division. And then we've got the co-main event of OSP moving back down to heavyweight after his little dalliance. He's moving back down to lightweight after his little dalliance at heavyweight, where he was totally, totally outclassed. He's taking on Alonzo Manfield. Marcin Prachnio taking on Mark Rodriguez. Mariah Agapova fighting again. She's taking on Shayna Dobson. And then rounding off the main card, we've got Daniel Rodriguez taking on Takashi Sato. So that's going to be an interesting fight next week. So tune in for that. But yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at DJ Kirby. Follow Carlos here at Kirby_Carlos. Follow this show at 5 Rounds Pod. Thank you all for listening. And that is the end.
Adios, amigos.
TheChairShot.com. Always use your head.